So thanks very much for turning up, everybody. Last time I did a presentation on this topic, this is the third of a sequence. I was in Bristol and I was just coming on after Andrei Alexandrescu. I had about 2 minutes to prep and I had a total failure of everything. So the laptop refused to connect to the projector. The wireless doodad for controlling it failed to work. I had to go run to find somebody. So if you ever watch that video, you see me coming on and I'm panting really hard at the beginning because I've just gone for like multiple jogs backwards and forwards. And then I suddenly had to get into it. So this time around, I've had a full 20 minutes to calmly collect myself. And I'm hoping that this will make for a much less embarrassing looking video when the time comes. We'll see what happens. I don't know, I put on a bit of weight, I think, since last year. So I'm not sure. I'm going to watch the video and kind of go, maybe. Do you know something else that's kind of funny? I see the crowd around, and I assume if you're here, you must be dedicated, hardcore, file system people. It's very funny, because if you put advanced into the title of the talk, you get a whole lot of people turning up in America. But if you do it in Britain, nobody turns up. Whereas if you make a beginner's talk over here, like this one is here, nobody turns up in America. But in Britain, you pack the place out. I mean, you're easily the biggest thing on the track. So that just goes to show a difference in culture between Britain and here. So next year, this time next year, I will put advanced into the title and I will be in the biggest room, probably down at the bottom floor or something like that. And I'll be like, oh, I can't see my audience. So that's going to make it real painful to do questions. But I don't know, John Lakers was telling me that advanced is the way forward. Put advanced in your title and constantly going about how hard it is if you're going to present here in America. Now, as much as actually this is labeled as a beginner's talk, it's only actually beginners because we start from first principles. It does get quite hard. Concurrency is difficult. So yeah, I will try my best to keep stopping to ask, let you guys ask questions, and we'll hopefully, yeah, get there. Yeah. So it's an interesting algorithm. Yeah, so what I've done is I've broken it down into sections. Obviously, this being a third part of a sequence, and I have to start again kind of from the start because I assume nobody here is familiar with this stuff. So there's about a third of the total hour goes on prerequisites, and it's just showing this is an API, except it works, this is how it looks like, and it has these semantics. We'll then spend another third getting into the actual algorithm. I'll do it twice, so you'll get an overview to begin with, and then we'll get into actual nitty-gritty detail, and I even have some code to show you, because there's actually some bits when you're describing an algorithm, it's just quicker to show the C++ code and read it, rather than trying to describe it in English. So that's coming. And then we'll get into benchmarks where there's lots and lots of graphs because I'm very keen on testing your assumptions and I have done a whole lot of testing and there's a whole lot more testing I'm not even going to show you. All right. Let's test if the doodah works. Oh yeah, I'm going to try something new this time. I bought a new one of these after the failure last time. So instead of using a mouse pointer, you know the way you can do one of these red dots and it's terrible for the video online. So I am going to try doing this thing. Ooh, I know. And I'm hoping this turns out really well in the video because a lot of people watch the videos. Nobody comes to talks in America, but everybody watches the videos for some reason or other. So I'm hoping this will be a lot better for the video and we'll see what happens. I'm going to try doing it a bit new. The only trouble is the range in this is not very good. So if it suddenly starts going all over the place, I'll have to just walk a bit closer. So if you see me suddenly breaking into a jog, that's what it is. All right. So contents, we're going to do a quick overview of the history, the current status. We are then going to get into the base class of the shared filing system mutex, and it is basically a shared mutex that runs on the filing system, so you can use it to coordinate between multiple processes. It has an abstract base class, so you don't have to care about the implementation, you can write your code generically. We're then going to get into the high-level overview, as I was mentioning, about a third of the time we'll be on talking about the algorithm. We have detail, so we'll do it twice so you can really get your head wrapped around it. And then we got benchmarks. We have four different types of implementation of this algorithm. This is the fourth. So this will let you compare the scalability characteristics of all four against one another. And they're very different, that's deliberately so. Okay, so history. I began this library in 2012. I don't expect it to go back for another peer review round until 2019 at the earliest. And I expect them to reject it again. So it'll probably be 2021 before you're actually going to see any progress on this, which is fine. This is something you do outside of work. So it goes very slowly, but it means you can take a bit of care and time with it, which helps. So you don't have to rush it like you do a lot of stuff you do at work. And what's the motivation? So here's the really funny thing about file systems, and most people have been programming for years, and yet you still, in 2016, cannot atomically update more than one file at once on modern filing systems. It is true that Microsoft brought in transactional NTFS a number of years ago that let you do this, and this was a great new feature, and it was really advertised. Nobody used it. Nobody used it, even though it was great and it solved this problem. And it could well be that I'm building something here which nobody will ever use. That's the whole point of doing a boost library. Is that you build this beautiful cathedral that nobody ever touches, and that's half the fun. I will say, though, that I'm not just building this for the sake of it. I'm going to build stuff on top of it. So one of the more interesting things is a transactional file system layer. So you have the file system TS, which is now coming in C++ 17. I'm going to implement that again, but this one's going to be secure. So in other words, it will actually definitely write your data. It will definitely do transactions and do a whole lot of other fun, cool, handy stuff that if you want to persist data reliably, be really handy to have. So it's not just for the sake of it. It's a building block. Most people, of course, use SQLite whenever they need to do proper data persistence and reliability. So what you do is you have some problem and you found that sudden power data loss, but data loss from sudden power loss. And what you do then immediately, almost everybody immediately grabs a copy of SQLite, figures out a way of shoehorning your current data structures into SQL and fire them into the database. A former employer of mine that I used to work at, a large multinational who makes phones, I shall otherwise not mention them, used SQLite to store the email database. And every time you transferred an email off a previous device, it would write as a single transaction the new stuff in. And of course, that causes an fsync, because that's what SQLite does every time you update a record. So if you're transferring 10,000 new emails, or in some cases, 50,000 new emails, you were writing each email, fsync, writing next email, fsync, writing next email, fsync. It was taking about 26 hours to transfer over emails between devices, and that's what happens when you badly use SQLite to do data persistence. The next thing is, this is something that's kind of not a problem quite just yet, but it's going to become a really big problem in the near future. We still can't, in 2016, write DMA-friendly zero-copy storage code. And that might seem to be not particularly important, except for maybe large bulk transfers. But I'll give you some notion. The fastest SSD currently on the market, just released a few days ago, it can do 3.4 million 4K IOPS. So that's IOs per second. If you work out what the maths is for that, it's about 12 gigabytes a second. The main memory on my developer machine that I use for work has a total memory bandwidth, main memory bandwidth, of about 24, 25 gigs a second. So this SSD can already occupy about half of my, admittedly, fairly old developer machine. But the point is, these things are going exponentially better and better and better. In a few years' time, you're going to have a 10 million IOPS SSD. And now you've got a major problem, because if you ever copy memory, ever, between the device and using it, you've just lost a large chunk of the performance of your SSD. You're also wrecking your caches, because you're just polluting all the data in your caches and throwing them out. You're going to kill your performance. Does anybody know how many times the C++ standard requires I/O to copy memory? Anybody have any idea? Nobody going to take a guess?
Zero.
Oh, God, it's not zero. It is twice. It's at least twice. That's correct. How many times does the way in which the standard has written force the kernel to copy memory when you're using I/O streams? Anybody? Oh. I reckon it's at least once. So that makes a total of three times that memory has to be copied for every I/O that you do with C++ I/O streams. If you combine that with an SSD that's coming soon, you're going to be only using about a third of its capacity. So this is one of those things where legacy designs have been made foolish through the progress of technology. It's hardly the first time it's happened, of course. Last thing, of course, is how is it still so hard to write bug-free file system code? Now, I've been banging the drum on the infamous directory deletion anti-pattern in Windows. So this basically, who's not heard of that yet? Oh, wow, okay, I've not been banging the drum too loudly then. Okay, yeah, so I've been banging this drum now for a year and a bit. And there's a number of people who are very keen on AFIO, who sort of monitor the directory, have been reporting these bugs into various well-known open source projects, where usually they get closed as invalid, won't fix. even though their file system code is just wrong. So the great trouble on Windows is that when you delete a file, you don't actually delete a file. You mark the file for later deletion by Windows whenever Windows gets around to it, which takes a few milliseconds usually, but it depends, it can take longer. So if you're directly deleting a directory tree, you're going to run through and you're going to find all the different files, you're going to delete them and then delete the directory that contained the files. But if the files, after you delete them, don't actually get deleted for some unspecified period of time, then your attempt to delete the directory containing them is going to fail because the directory still has items in it. And if you look through lots and lots and lots of code, it's wrong. If you have too much load on the filing system, that code will fail, and it will fail to delete the directory tree. And yet, when you report this sort of stuff, people say, well, I've never seen it in my test circumstance on my particular machine, so I'm just going to close this invalid won't fix. But if you put it on certain storage, or if the storage is heavily loaded, the time to delete a file might go up to tens of milliseconds, hundreds of milliseconds. I have seen 2 seconds in extreme cases. And if it's taking 2 seconds to actually delete a file, you're going to actually see that in practice. So people like to close bugs as won't fix invalid because on an ideal machine that they're testing with, this isn't a problem. But users who are out there are doing all sorts of crazy stuff. So this is one of those things where it's really quite hard with standard facilities to actually write bug-free file system code. Can anyone think of a quick way to fix this as a quick remedy? So this directory tree deleting problem. Do a while loop, exactly correct. So when it fails, just come back, redo the deletion, and just keep looping it and looping it and looping it until it eventually goes away. That's a really inefficient way of doing it, of course. There's a much better way of doing it again, and my hope is that AFIO in the future, in its algorithms library, will have an ideal implementation for Windows, an ideal implementation for POSIX and so forth. But no, you're completely correct. While loop is all it needs. So AFIO v2, it's a bare metal design. As you know with Boost, libraries go through a peer review process, so you write the thing, you finish it, you have it lovely tested, you submit it for peer review, wait around 2 to 3 years until the community actually gets around to reviewing it. They will then completely pan, destroy it, and say it's complete crap, which they did in my case, and I was universally rejected across the board. But that's not the point. The point is they come back with lots and lots of really useful feedback to say of what you need to do instead. And it was very clear that Boost usership did not like the idea of removing quirks. If anything, what they want is to see more quirks. So, V2 gives you all the quirks you could ever imagine. It does nothing at all with the operating system. Whatever the operating system does, whatever weirdnesses it has, you just get straight passed through to you, unfiltered. All you get is a portable API. It will be as buggy as the operating system is. The other thing was I had a lot of criticism about resource management and use of shared pointers to enforce a async IO model that was universal, so that's all gone. We no longer have any threads whatsoever. We don't even allocate memory anymore. We don't do any resource management because we don't ever allocate any resources. And we don't throw any exceptions because what's the point of throwing exceptions if you never do any of these things in the first place? So what we have instead is these things called, let me try my red flashing thing, mongrel monadic outcomes. This is almost certainly somebody in this audience will ask, ooh, you've gone about monads. Can you tell me more about your monad implementation? I guarantee you, it's happened every single time so far. I've got good news. At ACCU 2017, that's the next one in Bristol next April, I'm planning to submit a talk on just those. So all your questions will be answered. I'm happy to, of course, answer questions about them now. But they're really quite boring, and I have a single slide that summarizes them in a single go. They're boring, but what they make possible is not boring. So that's the kind of really fun part. The other thing is that the overhead is incredibly low. I have a Python script that counts assembler opcodes generated in terms of overhead around the syscalls, and it keeps them down to hundreds to make sure that there's no explosion of overhead that comes out of nowhere. So you'll never be able to measure any overhead anymore. And that was one of the other major criticisms during peer review. So this is as good as using the host APIs in terms of measurable outcomes. The other thing that I was criticized on was that there wasn't really much of a mapping between the C++ type system and the file system, and there was a really good reason for that. It was because on Windows XP, you couldn't cancel I/O. So how do you implement a destructor if you can't cancel the I/O that's pending? You can't do it. Unfortunately, well now fortunately, because we've got rid of Windows XP support, now we can. So with Windows Vista onwards, we can finally cancel I/O just like we can in POSIX. That lets us let our destructors cancel I/O, and voila, we now have a tight mapping. So that's really, really handy. The core file system library is now exposed into the AFIO FTL, file system template library. This is indeed one of the bits we're building. And the other thing as well is I was talking to Bjarne, I was at lunch with him a few days ago, And it was an interesting thing that we're talking about light, clean C++. You know, what is complex C++ versus really nice, simple C++? And I think most people who look at AFIO V2 code will find it very easy to follow. And that's something I'm very proud of. So it uses a lot of the proposed 17 idioms and a lot of library features coming out of 17. And is obviously fairly hefty on the 14 language. So what's been happening since last time I did a presentation? So that's since April. So there's no real new feature work. The reason why there's no real feature work is because I have been very busy on a build system. So it needed a test suite. Last time I presented in Bristol, there was no test suite whatsoever. And when people said, when can I start using this library? I said, don't. It hasn't been tested. Just don't do it. I have the beginnings of a test suite now. It's rather interesting. It does stuff like C-test. It has a new thing called boost kernel test, which is a new way of doing unit testing. It actually builds on top of any existing unit testing library. It's a way of running that library. It's a runner for a unit test library. So you don't have to use catch if you don't want to. Use boost test, Google test, whatever you feel like. Kernel test is a design pattern, if that makes sense. And here are some of the fun things it can do. I'm not going to talk too much about this because this time next year, so this is CPPCon 2017, my intention is to submit a paper talking about, you guessed it, all of, oh, where's my red mouse pointer? See, technology never works. Talking about all of this, so you're going to see all of these fun new features turning up if this thing gets approved. And I won't bother reading them out because you can all read. Now, BoostLight, you may have know or not know, is my lightweight emulation layer for Boost. So in other words, it emulates a Boost library, which means you no longer have a dependency on Boost. It's been expanding and growing and growing and growing. It does lots and lots of really cool new stuff. I, again, will not talk about any of this particular thing. You can also read. The reason why is so immature. I literally finished writing this a week or two ago. It already does C++ modules, for example, so it's automatically compiling all of your code into C++ modules. I was talking to Gabby, and I said, yeah, my stuff's blowing up your C++ modules implementation. It just dies. And he says, send me a repro. So I quickly fired together a repro, and they're working on it. So that is an example of stuff in action. It's there, it has to be disabled, obviously, on current Microsoft compilers, which is fine. But this fixes a lot of the things, and you might notice this looks awfully like a reboot of Boost, almost like a Boost version 2. It doesn't have all the problems that Boost has. So for example, they're getting a massive collection of flat libraries. You can just download them one by one. They automatically get packaged. They automatically get put in ready for use. You can just drop them into your project without having to do any installation or configuration. All the design decisions here have been a long, long time coming. I've actually spent most of this week meeting up with various Boost people to discuss what they'd like out of something like this. So this is hopefully going to turn into something. We'll see what happens. And just to prove that this really is all working and is all ready to go, here is my C-dash for Boost AFIO. And please, red mouse pointer, work. So you don't have to stand right close to the thing. So you'll see here, here's the Windows. This is coming off AppVar, and as you can see, there are 6 warnings and 30 tests are passing, and it all just works. The warnings, by the way, are failure to build documentation because AppVar doesn't have a copy of Doxygen installed, so it warns. Here's your documentation coming out of Travis, and here are a whole load of interesting build errors. So the question is why is there a whole load of build errors in Linux? The reason why is because Linux support doesn't work. It's incomplete. So there's a series of to-do errors that pop up whenever you try to run it on Linux. And I know I promised last time around I was going to implement Linux support for this. I just haven't got around to it. I'm still working on the validation and test suite. Once I have that part working, I'll more than happily fill in the Linux support and the rest of POSIX, of course. Here's actually the binaries that are dumped out by the build system. So every time there's a successful build, you'll see that the source file gets generated. You can see that outcome's down there and it's getting its source generated and up at the top. There's binaries being generated for Win64. So this is all just working. The infrastructure is ready to go. All right. So the thing we're talking about today, obviously, is a shared filing system, Mutex. So I'm just going to give a quick API overview of how that's built. And that will hopefully give you the prerequisites to understand the algorithm later on. So I mentioned earlier on mongrel monads. I said they're very boring. They really, really are, but what they make possible is really exciting. So a basic monad consists of a type T, so whatever type it's wrapping, an error code, so that matches an error code implementation, std error code, and an exception pointer, matching type, so that's something that matches the profile of std exception pointer. That could also be boost error code and boost exception pointer, or any other thing that matches those two. That's up to you. This is obviously a fairly complicated thing to use, so we've aliased them into convenience at type defs. So there's an outcome T, and that can have the following variant states of empty T, std error code, or std exception pointer. A result T is empty or T or error code. Option T, which looks awfully like an std optional, is either an empty or a T. These have a full set of monadic operators available for them, so you can use them as monads. I recommend you don't because they increase compile times. So if you just don't use them as monads, instead treat them a bit like the Rust monad, which is what obviously is the inspiration from the naming of result and option, then you're going to get on very well. And these produce really high quality code. If you look at the assembler that's generated by these, it's beautifully optimized. That was due to me spending many weeks with all the major compilers, iterating, trying different C++ constructs and checking the assembler and just constantly repeating them until I got something that all the optimizers were happy with. So that is for free if you use this stuff. And as I say, I'll be talking a lot more about these in Bristol next April. They have an identical API to a future and optional. So just consider them that they've got a get, they got a value, and they got a has value. These are very, very uncontroversial. So when you're looking at the APIs later on, and they're all returning a result, because every single API in AFO is no except, so it never throws exceptions, but it does return an empty. An empty, or a T, or an error code. Okay, the second thing you're going to need to know as a prerequisite is the byte range lock API. So who here does not know what a byte range lock is? Okay, we've got a few. Right, so the kernel of any operating system will allow you to say in a file that I want to lock between this offset and the file for this duration. And you can say that I want to lock this for exclusive usage, so only I can use it, or you can lock it for shared usage, in which case I and a whole lot of other people can use it, or you can have no locks at all, obviously, and that would be the default. These have been built into operating system kernels for years and years and years and years. They're part of POSIX, so any POSIX implementation has to implement them. Windows has an implementation as well, obviously. And they are relatively straightforward. It's basically the kernel lets you lock items in a file. Now, something that's really important to understand is that you don't have to actually lock files that, or bytes that exist. So the file can be zero length, and you can lock 1 megabyte to 1 megabyte plus 1 byte, and that works just fine. So you can lock bytes that don't exist, and the idea is that if you're extending a file, you could lock off the end of the file, you could extend the file with extra stuff, and that all just works. As you can see, later on, we're going to be using this facility of locking bytes that don't exist to do a whole lot of stuff that it was never really intended for. And that, of course, is the whole point of having an abstraction library. You might notice the large smiley face down here at the bottom. And I go on about insanity and insane semantics. The reason why I go on about that is because POSIX very unfortunately has some very unhelpful semantics when it comes to byte range locks. Essentially, if you have multiple file handles open to the same file, same inode on POSIX, and any one of those files is closed, then all byte range locks on that file are automatically cancelled. So if you're writing library code and you don't know what the rest of the process is doing, and someone comes along and opens the file you're working with and happens to close it on POSIX, you will lose all your byte range locks and you've got instant data corruption. That's a really stupid semantic, but it's written into POSIX, so everyone has to conform to it whether they want to or not. And it's completely insane. And in fact, there's a flag in AFIO, which is called byte range insanity. And it gets set whenever it detects that POSIX locks are insane. You'll see here that in the IO handle, so you'll notice here that this is a handle which does IO, and it subclasses handle, which is simply a handle that manages a open file descriptor or handle. You'll see here there's an extent type, and that is effectively an unsigned long. You have this RAA guard, resource acquisition, it's initialization guard, called extent guard, and that looks very like a std lock guard, if you're familiar with one of those. And you then have this virtual function called lock. It takes an offset in, a number of bytes, whether it's exclusive or not, a deadline to complete it by, and it returns back a result, which of course could contain an error code or an extent guard. So if it returns an extent guard, it's succeeded, and then when you destruct the extent guard, it will unlock the byte range. You might notice the deadline. Deadline is because you might have noticed in C++ 11 that there's a lot of wait for and wait until taking some std chrono time point or duration. These are great and everything, but unfortunately they're templatized, and that means you can't have a stable ABI with a DLL boundary. So I came up with this thing called a deadline instead, and it's simply a C-compatible wrapper for a duration or a time point. So you can feed a std chrono time point or a std chrono duration into a deadline, and it will do magic and convert it into the correct internal representation. And because deadline is a fixed ABI container, you can pass it through a DLL boundary, and there's no problems with templates getting in the way of that. So that's what a deadline does, and a null deadline, so a default initialized one, means infinite. So in other words, the default is to wait forever and never ever to cancel. If you passed in zero, that means don't wait at all. And in fact, I think you should probably see that very shortly. Later on, we'll be comparing lock ranges, byte ranges, atomic append, and that comes from the ACCU talk last April. And this is the one we're going to be workshopping later on today, is the memory map. And those are the four implementations I'm probably going to stop at because they're good enough for people to get going. And you can, of course, write your own if you so chose. Okay, so abstract base class for a shared FS mutex, and this is the thing we're going to be subclassing in our memory map implementation. So hopefully, first thing is that your entity type is a 63-bit value plus a 1-bit of exclusive. The reason why this is the case is because on POSIX, byte range offsets are a 63-bit quantity, not a 64-bit quantity, because they're signed, which is very unfortunate. So what we do is we enforce the same 63-bit extent on both Windows and on POSIX. So this could be viewed as problematic if you ever wanted to lock off the end of the bytes, off the end of the thing. But that's okay, because if you want to get down to the nitty-gritty, you can just use the lock API directly. These things are an abstraction above the lock API, so, and they're not really using the full range, they're using it for other semantics, so it doesn't matter if we're chopping off the top bit. Entities type, which is this thing here, has been set to a thing called a GSL span, taking the entity type just below. Does anybody not know what a GSL span is? Oh my, oh my, oh my. Okay, these were the highlight of CppCon last year. So Neil McIntosh and Bjarne both presented as part of the keynote this brand new thing called spans. Spans are great. Spans are effectively what Rust would call a borrowed reference, and they are on track for C++17.20, my apologies, standardization. And you can already use them. You can get the library already from Microsoft. Martin Boyne from the ACCU has also done his own clone. There's a number of other people who have their own implementations of GSL spans. So you can just grab one of the copies, and we use them very, very extensively in AFIO. In fact, they're the core of the lock or the zero copy scatter gather IO system is based on spans. They just save so much complexity. So I strongly recommend if you're not using GSL span, go look into it and start adopting it. Once again, we've got an RAA guard called entities guard. And we have here this lock method, which takes an entities type, which of course is a GSL span of 63-bit values with exclusive. We have a deadline, which again is defaulted to infinite. We also have this Boolean called spin not sleep, because there's always people who don't want stuff to sleep, they want it to spin forever. And down here we have try lock, and that simply aliases through to the very same lock that we had up above. The difference is that we're passing in std chrono seconds of zero. So in other words, don't wait around. If it fails to lock, immediately return. And both of these have virtual written around them, even though they're not actually virtual functions, but they do call a virtual function, so you can override them in any particular subclasses. So all makes sense so far? Cool. So the first question that I kind of expected somebody to ask was why are we locking many entities at once? Because if the underlying lock byte range lock system is only ever taking one range at a time, then why would we have multiple entities? That's a really good question. This is the reason why, and here are some benchmarks. So this is on a 4-core, 8-thread CPU. And if you notice the green line at the top, this is an uncontended lock. So these are byte range locks simply going off and doing as many locks as possible. And down at the bottom, you can see there's concurrency. So if you have two things running, then you're going to get a good bit more performance, three things more, because it's all uncontended for the green line. For the red line, this is where they're trying to lock the same set of bytes. And obviously, if you've got one thing doing it, it's going to have good performance. For two, because the two of them are going to run into each other, and they're only one of them is going to be able to progress, there's overhead, and you get performance dropping, and you get that popping out that way. So these are the scaling curves for simple byte range locks on NTFS. You get different curves if you're on FAT32 and different curves again on X4, FreeBSD, and so on and so forth, especially FreeBSD and Linux. Linux has really awful scaling curves currently. FreeBSD has lovely scaling curves. So the reason why we have multiple entities is because here is a graph of locking 5 entities. So that's the green line. Here we go with my red pointer. And you can see the red line from before where we have a contended 1 entity. And you can see that if you wanted best worst case performance, then you could break up your granularity of locking into 5 bits, lock all 5 and unlock all 5, and you're going to get the same performance as if you had one giant lock. So this is where having more than one entity comes in handy. It lets you break up the granularity of locking such that more things can progress uncontended rather than slamming into a single giant unified lock. And of course, this is classical concurrency theory. So that's the reason why we have more than one. And you'll find that there are algorithms in the shared FS mutex later on, which let you lock as many entities as you want with no cost. So that's another big advantage. How are these things mapped onto stuff? So lockfile, which is one of the implementations I mentioned earlier, you simply take the 63-bit value, you convert it into hexadecimal, you create a file using OExclusive on the filing system, and if things run into each other, then you're going to get collision and you back off. For byte ranges, you simply call the byte range API in the kernel. And contention is handled the same way as std, is it std lock? Is when you lock many mutexes in the C++ standard library, you have an algorithm that effectively works by trying to lock each one of the mutexes in sequence. As soon as you find one that doesn't lock, you then back out and unlock all of them, you randomize the list, and you do it again and again and again until eventually you get through. We have a slight variation on that. We take the one that's contended and we put it at the very front. We can then sleep on locking it, and that means the CPU doesn't get used up. So other than that, it's exactly the same as the algorithm in the C++ standard library. So the one that we did last Bristol, it solves the problem of inverse log scaling. So you'll find on all the graphs that there's this huge drop off, and it solves the problem. It just has a nice flat line. You'll see that later on in the graphs. It's really great for worst case performance. That's where that comes in. And here's a graph exactly showing what I mean. So you'll see here that the blue line is lock files. And by the way, this is a log graph. These are going up in units of multiples of 10. Lock files is way down here, and it falls off with the number of entities. The thing we did in Bristol is a straight flat line. It doesn't care about the number of entities. And here are the byte range locks. And later on, you're going to see a graph that adds the thing that we're about to build on top of that. And this is the thing that we're going to build. It has lots of problems in terms of caveats, and nobody should really use it, but I bet you it's going to become the most popular thing because it has excellent average case performance and terrible worst case performance. But that's okay, people love their average case performance. Okay, and this is the last bits of reference. I appreciate that I am about 10 minutes past where I was hoping to be at this point, so I'll have to go and push onwards. Okay, so any questions before we begin? Yes.
So you never explained exactly what span is. Is that an open-ended interval?
A span underneath the bonnet is two pointers. So there's a pointer to a T and another pointer to another T. And the assumption is that between the first pointer and the second pointer will be a contiguous set of T's. So, and then you can obviously have the length off of that. So it's basically a range of sorts in that, that points to one and ends at another. Is that okay?
So is that like a linear piece of memory?
It's a linear piece of memory, yes. And the big advantage with span is that because the compiler knows what one of those is, it can do static analysis checking, tell you when you're doing something stupid with it. It can also do runtime checking to test if you're doing something stupid at runtime. And Neil McIntosh gave a talk on span yesterday, and he says that there's a whole lot of stuff going into Visual Studio which will allow other tooling to figure out when spans are happening and do things like Valgrind, for example, could be, say, enhanced to do checks with span. So it's a form of markup to tell the compiler what you really mean by these two pointers. And does that basically explain it? It's not my code, ultimately. And watch the video for Neil McIntosh's talk yesterday, or indeed the one from last year, if you want to know all about spans. Any other questions? Okay. So the thing about the shared map algorithm is that we have a shared piece of memory in the process, or in the computer. And kind of pretty obvious that if you have a network drive user coming in from Samba or off NFS or whatever else, they can't see memory maps in your machine. So this algorithm is only good if there aren't any network drive users. And that's a problem because we're going to have to go and detect when network drive users turn up in a portable fashion and do the right thing by disabling the shared memory maps. This is a bit tricky to do. So therefore, we're going to have a fallback lock, and it's going to be something that does work with shared network drive systems. And we're going to use the shared memory map initially and then fall back to the fallback lock when a network drive user turns up. So the other big trickiness is that we need to get all of the people who are currently using the shared memory map to drop out of the shared memory map together whenever a network drive user turns up and not end up getting out of state with one another in a portable fashion. It starts getting a bit harder again. And before we do all of that, we need to figure out some way of portably detecting that network drive user. So no custom APIs, no hacking into the Windows kernel and using special op-lock detection, because of course op-locks don't exist in OSX and FreeBSD, even though they both have Samba. So what are you going to do? You're going to have to come up with something else. Now, I'm not going to claim that what I came up with here is the best idea in the world, but it probably works. let's see what happens. So when we're constructing it, if the lock file doesn't exist, we're going to have to erase-free create the map file, so a file that's going to be shared memory mapped, and I'm saying we're going to put it somewhere inside slash temp, or whatever the file that your operating system claims is slash temp. So in other words, your temp directory. We're going to write the path of that temp directory or temp file into the lock file. That means other processes can come along and read the location of the temp file. If the file already exists, the lock file is already there, we are going to open the lock file, read the path of that temporary file somewhere, which will be in slash temp. If the file exists, then we know we're on the same machine as the other people currently using the lock, and therefore we're going to go and be able to get on and use the shared memory map. If, on the other hand, the file doesn't exist, then we're probably a network drive user, and we're going to have to somehow signal to everybody else to stop using the shared memory map. And I'm going to call this, in red, degrade the lock. After we've done all of this, we're going to map the lock file into memory read-only, and we're going to go and map the map file into memory read-write because we're going to be using it as the IPC mechanism. Can anyone hazard a guess why we need to map the lock file into memory read-only and not read-write? Yeah, that's a pretty difficult answer. The reason why is because there are page caching bugs in the kernel. And if you try doing I/O to a file that's also memory mapped, certain operating systems that say are made by a fruit-themed company, which will remain nameless, tend to corrupt the data that's inside the file. So you map it read-only, and you don't have that problem. They have actually fixed the problem in the very most recent releases of their fruit-themed devices, but for a long stretch of years, this was a problem. It used to just eat your data. So this is why we keep it read-only, and we avoid the problem in the first place. Now, there's an enormous assumption here, and the big assumption is that slash temp is not going to be visible to network drive users. Can anybody think when that wouldn't be the case? Sorry, the comment at the back was that Windows... So the question, or the point was that on Windows, you can go to share and you can get to slash temp. You can, but I believe that the operating system will return something inside slash users, well, on Windows 7 or later, slash users, your username, local settings. Somewhere inside there is going to be your temp directory.
Yeah, if you use your local temp. Yeah. I was thinking about any user could just get on the machine.
So the point was that if you use the path that's returned by the operating system, any user could still get into it, and you're completely correct. But because each instance of this algorithm is going to go and ask the Windows operating system what is the temp directory, it's going to give back something local to the local user. That's going to be seen by other programs running under the local user correctly, but if it's running under a different user on the same machine, or if it's a network drive user, it should pick up a different temp directory. Does that make sense?
If I have the same user on two machines,
so the observation is that if you have the same user logged into two machines and the temp directory is shared over the network between the two machines...
just queries. If it queries locally, what's my temp directory? That is also my temp directory over there.
So as you, the observation was that if you query what the local temp directory is, and it will say that's the temp directory over there, which I'm assuming you're saying is going to some sort of network drive resource.
Oh, I even just mean in the way he was saying it. Like, I see users temp my name on the local machine, but I also have a my name account on the remote machine. I very well could have a see users my name temp directory on both instances.
So the observation was that you could end up having my users temp directory on both instances. And that is absolutely correct, in which case this thing will spectacularly fall down. the big assumption is that this is the case. If it's not the case, this algorithm blows up. That's the truth of it. I've been sitting there thinking about a better way of doing this, and forgetting portable code is really quite hard, and I'm hoping that most network drive administrators would map the temp directory to something on local storage and not something on network storage. But I completely agree with you that if they don't do that, we have problems. Any other questions? All right, 20 minutes to go. All right, so to lock. This is the overview of the algorithm. Has the shared memory mapping degraded? If it has, we're going to pass through to the fallback lock. Otherwise, we're going to take each entity, which you remember was the 63-bit number that came in, and we're going to hash it by the total number of items that are in the shared memory map. We're going to try and lock the spin lock in the shared memory map at that particular hash index. If it fails to lock, we unlock everything, so we back out all of the locks we've made on all the different entities. We randomize the list that we're going to lock in, the order of things we're going to lock in, and we're going to retry it. So this is effectively using no syscalls whatsoever. It's entirely using shared memory for everything, and as a result, ought to be quite quick. Unlock is exactly the same thing, but in reverse. You simply take all of the one spin locks you had locked before, and you unlock them in reverse order. The fallback lock, obviously, is case that if lock's shared memory map is degraded. So quick characteristics. There are some consequences of this. You're doing one atomic operation for every single entity you're locking. In fact, you're probably doing more than one atomic operation, because if you try to ever implement a spin lock that can do exclusive and shared locking, it's really hard to implement one of those without doing at least two atomic operations on the one area, unless, of course, you use more memory. So if you're using a single 4-byte word or 8-byte word, you're going to probably have to use more than one atomic operation to implement a shared semantics on such a spin lock. So as a result, you're going to do a lot of atomics if you ever get collision. And of course, atomics are bad because there's only a finite system bandwidth for one of those. We have no ability to sleep the CPU. That's common with any spin lock that you have. The spin locks I'm using do have a counter, and if they keep being blocked for long enough, they will go off and call sleep, but that's hardly sleeping. The CPU is very expensive on battery. The last thing is kind of a bit more subtle. Most of the time with an open addressing scheme that I just described, what you do is if you find a hash collision, you're going to move left by one or move right by one. So you're going to probe left or right. In this case, it turns out if you do that, performance goes through the floor. And the reason why is because you're increasing cache line bouncing between the different processes. So probing left and right is a terrible, terrible for performance. So what you do instead is you have to use a very high quality hash function, one that never has collisions. And that obviously costs, but it's the least worst option out of the different things that are happening. And I did this purely through empirical testing. So I can tell you this is the case rather than proving it to you. And of course, the other thing is that this is a very antisocial algorithm. If you run multiple ones of these, they're just going to peg all your CPUs. Your mouse pointer is going to start jittering because it can't keep up with the amount of atomic operations that are happening. You know, it's just really, really fast, but it's really terrible to anything other code that's on there, and it's terrible to battery life. On the other hand, I guarantee you everybody's going to use it because they always go for the aggregate performance. Okay, so this thing that we're implementing, we're going to get into detail now, having had the overview. This is the second round of explaining the algorithm. Obviously, because we're building a Boost library, we're going to use some templates. So the template that we have, I mentioned that we had to have a very high quality hash function, and I went for the FNV1A hash, which is a reasonable speed with reasonable quality. The hash index size can be specified to be anything you want. You can obviously override your hasher, and you can also change the type of spin lock type we have. I've gone for a shared spin lock, which is something out of Boost Lite. As I mentioned, it is compact, so it has a single, it's the same size as a normal spin lock, 4 bytes, 8 bytes, whatever it is, your size T. And it does multiple atomic operations to implement exclusive locking and shared locking using the same memory pointer, same amount of memory. The next thing is, rather, that down at the bottom, I have this thing where it says 1 megabyte plus 0. equals locking use, and 1 megabyte plus one equals mapping use. I would say just memorize the fact that they are, that's what they mean. I'll have them in brackets in a minute, and I'll explain them properly in about 4 slides. So the first thing I'm going to say is that this is a bit more detail. You remember that we mapped the lock file into memory, so, and the lock file has the path to the temp file in the temp directory. So the way that we test if this thing is valid or not, because it's mapped into memory read-only, if you remember, is we simply check its first byte. If the first byte is 0, it's dead. There's nothing in there. If it has something that's useful, it's probably a full path, and therefore we know whether the lock is degraded or not very, very quickly. If the lock has degraded, we're going to have to release the shared lock map and use byte at 1 megabyte plus 1. So you remember I was telling you about byte range locks can lock any arbitrary offsets inside the file. What we're doing is we're using 1 megabyte plus 0 as a marker to say that the lock file is in use. We're using the 1 megabyte plus 1 offset as the fact that the shared map is in use. This is the way we're doing the IPC communication between the multiple instances using it. So what we do is if the lock has been degraded, we're going to release our copy of the shared lock map and use byte. We're then going to exclusively lock the same thing that we just went and released, and then we're going to immediately release it again. And the reason why we're doing this is because it's a gate. It gates that particular instance that's using that particular shared memory map, and it causes it to wait until all other users of that shared memory map stop using it, if you think about it. So if they all have that shared byte offset with a shared lock, that means they can all use it concurrently. But as soon as someone comes along with an exclusive lock, that's going to hang and wait until everybody who has a shared lock releases their shared lock. You'll then get everyone who's waiting for an exclusive lock, who go one by one, will be allowed to proceed. So this gates everybody and waits until everybody stops using the shared memory map at one point, and then once everybody stopped, everybody proceeds from that point onwards. This is how we're implementing the lock degradation. This is how we go from having a shared memory map, and we're going to fall back to the fallback lock. Exactly what I just mentioned. If obviously we have only not just, if we've just degraded, we do this. If we've already degraded and it's already a degraded lock, we simply just jump straight to the fallback lock. All right. And you might remember, just a moment ago, I said that we had to hash every one of the items, the entities, in the map file and figure out which spin lock within the shared memory map file we're going to go and have. Down here, I mentioned here about auto-vectorizing SIMD and eliding index collisions, exclusive bit upgrade. I thought the best thing to do actually for that was just to show you some code, because it's kind of hard to explain what it's doing. It's an awful lot easier to show. So this is the implementation itself, and you'll see that I have this idea of an entity index, which is unsigned. Ooh, okay. So the entity index up here is the offset into the shared memory map. So it's going to be an unsigned integer because probably the shared memory map is never going to be bigger than one of those. There's no point using size t's here. And the other bit is whether the item is exclusive or not. So when we're hashing the entities, we take in a pointer to entity to IDX, so it's going to be an array, and we take in the entities list, which is a span. We're going to go and iterate the span because it has a size. We're going to call the hasher on each of the entities that came in, its value, which was the 63-bit thing that we mentioned before, and we're going to modulus it by the number of container entities. We're then going to copy over the exclusive part from the original entities into the thing that we're building. We then got to upgrade any existing hash entry collisions. So if we collide in a hash entry, and one of the things originally was exclusive, and the other one was not exclusive, then we need to always use exclusive, because exclusive is the stronger item. So what we're going to do is we're going to iterate through the list, and we're going to go and check if there's a collision. So the modulus value matches, and if it does, and the thing that we have is exclusive, and the thing that we are checking is not exclusive, we upgrade the thing that's already in the list by making it exclusive, and we don't bother adding the entry that we just added. So that's what I mean by upgrade. We simply run through the list, and we build up the list of spin lock indexes, and we make sure that the exclusive operation is upgraded on any situations where the same spin lock is hashed to and there's a hash collision. Have I hopefully explained that reasonably well? Or is everybody at this point going, ah, my head hurts? You're all right with it?
A little bit of both. I'm kind of with you.
Cool. Do you know, the weird thing was that in Bristol, I had a much, much more complicated algorithm. The difference is I have 90 minutes to explain it. To explain this stuff in 60 minutes is really quite hard. As you can tell by the time, I'm kind of like, we're taking way, way longer than I was expecting. So I was able to go into much more detail with the audience, and I kind of wrapped their head around it. And I, unfortunately, given there's only 10 minutes left, I'm kind of going to say I'm really sorry. But what I will be able to do is answer your questions at the end. And I also am contactable by email. So I'm afraid I'm going to have to move on. All right. Okay. So I think we've just gone through all of that stuff that I just mentioned. That's fine. Yeah. Let's go back. So for every entity we're locking, as I just mentioned before, if we're exclusively locking, we're going to exclusive lock the spin lock at that index, or else we're going to shared lock it. If the attempt to lock the spin lock fails, we're going to unlock everything that we locked so far. We're going to check if the deadline has passed, which it might have done, in case we're going to return E timed out. We're going to swap the contended index, the one that we collided upon, with the very first index, and we're going to call a struck through edition of standard random shuffle. The reason why it struck through is because until this conference, I didn't know that was deprecated. So when I was watching there a few days ago, Alistair Meredith talk, and he said, standard random shuffle's been deprecated. I was like, okay, so I'm gonna replace that with something better, and I have, and that's why it's now being deleted. But it still does the same thing. It randomizes the list between two iterators. The last thing it does then is it yields the thread context and gets onto retrying the sequence. So that's what happens when you're locking the memory map. Any questions? Everyone understands, cool. Unlocking is not particularly different. I'm gonna hash and modulus again, exact same routine. For every entity index, we're going to be, if it's exclusively locked, unlocked, we're going to exclusive unlock the spin lock, and if it's shared, we're going to unlock it the other way. And there's an early out optimization just here. So if the lock's newly degraded, then we're going to go and release our shared map and use byte to go and indicate to anything that's currently blocked on lock degrade that they can proceed. All right, I'm going to, unfortunately, due to lack of time, I'm going to have to skip the constructor and destructor completely, which is a real shame. They're also the most complex parts. So the ability to race free, construct one of these is quite subtle. The implementation I have actually has, to my knowledge, three known races in it, but those three races should never happen, to my best knowledge. I would say that you can go through the slides and you can actually work them out if you want to or look at the code, but due to time, I'm just going to simply jump them because they will take, easily 20 minutes to explain, I'm afraid to say. If you're struggling so far with the lock and unlock, you definitely will really struggle with the constructor and destruction sequence, because you have to bear in mind you've got multiple processes all coming along who could be constructing and destructing the lock at any random set of times and doing lock and unlock. And of course, there's network drive users coming in randomly, potentially, who are coming in and degrading lock concurrently with all of this. So because of that, the interactions are quite hefty. And as I say, I have four that I know of in terms of races. There's probably more. And it's a real shame I wasn't able to go into a bit more detail with that. But it is what it is. Time is the way it is. Okay, so I'm going to jump straight to the benchmarks. You can accept probably that this is correct. By the way, it's not that I have checked it by hand. I also have written a solver, and the solver goes off and fires a whole lot of CPU cores to go off and test this thing, and you leave it running for like several hours and to make sure that the thing doesn't come up with any race conditions. And insofar as the four-core machine that I have, it has never blown up. So I think it is correct in that sense, hopefully. Okay, so I'm going to jump down here to benchmarks. All right. So in order to keep these results comparable to my previous two presentations, I have kept it at this very old laptop I have, which is a 2-core, 4-thread, 2008 edition laptop. It's a really terrible machine to be testing in some respects because it's not really representative of modern hardware. I do have a whole set of benchmarks for a much newer machine, my main desktop machine, but in order to keep these results comparable to other ones that I've presented on, I've used the same hardware. I might add that this particular implementation has some caveats, as I kind of mentioned. The green ones are easy to fix. So I've already fixed the standard random shuffle in the last day or two. The lock degrade that I know is currently racy under multiple thread users of the same object instance. So you've got the same one lock and you've got multiple threads using it concurrently. I've aimed for that to be safe, but there is currently one known problem which is going to probably require some thread local data to get worked around. Next one is that networked users, if a networked user comes along and causes the lock degrade to happen, that currently blocks everybody until all users of the lock have realized that the degrade is happening. So if you've got some user who very infrequently is doing locks and unlocks but has an open handle to the lock, everything during the lock degrade is going to hang until that one person does a lock or an unlock operation. And that's a failure of the current implementation. You can work around that using an early out mechanism, but it complicates the algorithm quite significantly. Last thing that's wrong, and you can see it in red, is because I can't fix it, and that is that if you're on insane byte lock systems, you can't have multiple object instances. If you do, it's going to be racy for that reason that I was mentioning earlier. But if you close a file handle on the same file, everything else is going to lose their byte range locks, so there's nothing I can do about that. So here's the first graph, and this is exactly the same graph as you saw before, except it has a new purple line up at the top. So here is the performance of the shared memory maps. And you can see there that you're getting about, this is by the way contended, so this is when two threads are bumping into each other and they're trying to lock the same thing and you're having to kick out one of them because only one of the things can go through. So you're getting about 10 million operations per second, give or take, for shared memory maps. For byte ranges, you're down there to somewhere between 100,000 and a million. Good old atomic append is completely flat as a pancake, and lock files is way down there in the 1,000 to 10,000 range. This is for uncontended use, so things are going to be a lot faster. Your shared memory map is up there above the 10 million, I think it is, so it's about 20 million operations per second. You can see here, byte ranges are getting up about 1 million. And 100,000 for the atomic append, and so on and so forth. By the way, those are all on NTFS, probably because that's the most important thing. Concurrency scaling. Last time I did this in Bristol, people said, you didn't actually show us any benchmarks for concurrency and how it scales concurrency, so we're now actually going to do that. Are there any questions before I get to that? Over the corner.
Okay, so I got a question. I really don't know much about this library, so if my question is stupid, okay, you can have a nice round of laughter on me. But AFIO is very similar to ASIO, so I thought I was going to hear about routines that like asynchronously read from a file, and then they do the work in the background, and then they call you back. Am I thinking off base here? Or?
So the question was, is not AFIO like ASIO, which is going to turn into the networking TS? And the question is, when you came here, you were expected to see a whole lot of async stuff happening and routines, because that would match in with ASIO. The answer to that is interestingly, this is an interesting point. AFIO V1 did a lot of async, and if async wasn't available on the platform, it'd emulate it. V2 does nothing. So there's very little async anywhere in V2. The reason why is because on a SSD that's doing 4 million operations per second, async is way slower than synchronous. Way, way, way slower. I was just talking to a guy from the file system team at Microsoft during lunch break, and he was like, oh yeah, you're right. Because async does more work. Async has to require allocating a bit of memory for the async operation state. You have to go and manage that state during a period of time. You have to go and poll for items. You're doing more syscalls for async than synchronous. So if you have an SSD that's pushing 15 gig of RAM every second, you have to use synchronous if you're going to get all the performance out of it. So things have changed. When I started this back in 2012, I was thinking async all the way because I thought you're never going to get more than 500,000 IOPS a second. I was wrong. So we've had to do a pivot in the design of the library. It's now turning into a synchronous file system library, but it will still have some async in it if you so choose. So for magnetic hard drives, it's great. For network file systems, async is great as well. But for an SSD, not so great. Does that explain?
Yeah, very well, thank you.
Sorry about that. Yeah, I probably should do the basics before I get into this stuff. I know this is sort of from the first principles, building algorithms and implementing how to do the implementation. So I appreciate that the whole philosophy of why has been totally lost in this. All right, so I'll just quickly show this because we're actually 2 minutes away from time. This is for contended. So you'll see here that if you're comparing performance to one thread, which is number one, here you go. So obviously number one is number one. And these are all then relative to number one. And because these are contended locks, you would expect that performance drops. So with two concurrency, it's going to be less than one because things are blocking. Three concurrency is going to go down and down and down. You'll notice here for the atomic append, you're actually faster with two threads than you are with one. And I will just put that down to the filing system being a wonderful, wonderful thing. So that's contended. Uncontended, which is what most people actually care about. They say, how is my algorithm going to scale the more concurrency you give me? And the answer is not actually exceptionally particularly well, because the filing system, it gives you extra stuff. So say with a quad-core CPU, you're getting more performance up to four concurrency, but after that, you're running out of CPU cores. Most filing systems will give you extra concurrency up to the number of CPUs you have, and then they stop. And that's fine, because, you know, obviously it's not particularly great. You're getting an extra 80% performance for going four concurrency with byte ranges on NTFS. Other filing systems do way better. The memory maps that we just went and built, well, half built because we ran out of time to do the construction and destruction, they scale really, really nicely. So because they're all memory atomics, they go up with concurrency very, very nicely. And of course, with an 8-thread CPU, you can get reasonably good outcome from that. I know I've skipped through so much detail. I know I'm just showing synopses of stuff. All the actual detail that gives you as much detail as you could ever have is in Excel spreadsheets, and they are in the graphs directory of the AFI Git repo. You can see I've color-coded the structure, so you can see that the green stuff's really fast, the red stuff's really slow. I have all the permutations, so along the top there, you'll see there's NTFS, REFS, that's the reliable one, FAT32, and XFAT. And each of the columns then shows all of the structure between all of them. I was telling the file system guy from Microsoft that REFS is really weird performance characteristics, and he was like, huh, we didn't know. So I will be sending him a picture of the mottled, the one where there's weird sort of alternations between yellow and red, because that's not apparently the intended behavior. So that's cool, we've learned something new. All right, so there we go, that was the end, and we are 1 minute over time. I really am so sorry I got the timing so badly wrong on that. All I can say is you live and learn when you're presenting with this sort of stuff. And next time, I will not try to throw as much complexity into an hour as I have done. This was really, it turned out to be a 90-minute talk, and I got that very wrong. So my apologies. Are there any questions before we finish? Over here.
So how do users find the lock?
The question is how do the users find the lock? Can you explain in what mean?
You are not locking from one process, right?
So you're asking, you're not locking from one process. This is correct. So you have a filing system path, and what you do is when you come to the algorithm, you will specify some path to work from. And that will be the same path for all processes that come to it. So imagine if you have a collection of files and you want to lock exclusively access to those files, you probably would specify some location next to those files you're about to modify.
Yeah, it's just that was not visible there.
So the point was that was not visible in the thing I described. You are completely correct, and I apologize. You are correct. That never even occurred to me. I thought in my head, that yeah, silly me. Any other questions, or are you all keen to get out into the break?
Good talk.
No, it wasn't, but thank you very much for saying so.